Hey everybody, it's that time of year again when we remind you how you can support this podcast by becoming a member of The Incomparable. You can sign up for a monthly or annual pledge over at theincomparable.com/members. It'll ask you to pick the shows on the network you'd like to support. If you just check the box for Defocused, your entire contribution will come to us and we will finally be able to afford our Lamborghinis. If you listen to other podcasts on the network, you can check their boxes as well, and your contribution will be shared equally amongst the shows you want to support.
As a thank you for supporting us, members receive lots of extras. There's exclusive bonus audio, a bootleg podcast where you can hear the full uncut live recordings of our show right after the recorded without having to wait for the edited versions to arrive.
There's also a members-only community on Slack where you can write words that we will see. This is pledge season, so many of the shows on the network will be posting bonus episodes just for members.
There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 per month, and annual equivalents are available as well. If you're already a member, it's easy to increase your pledge to a higher level and get some special goodies in return. So if you'd like to support us, go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up. Thanks.
Damn it. Almost.
Thanks. Thanks. One more time. Thanks. Okay.
No, just leave all this in. It'd be great.
Thanks.
Oh, no.
Seth's like, I agreed to do three of these. Why?
I thought it was kind of funny when you sort of volunteered yourself for that. Regrets. No regrets. But welcome back to Back to the Future Part 2. That voice you hear is without the regret is Seth Worley, who is returning once again, and he will shed all of the light and insights that he has about the amazingness that is 2015.
To back to future.
I heard that somewhere before, but yeah,
it's like you said it once.
could have been, yeah. So we left off with them having a thing where Doc Brown showed back up.
Are you doing a previously on the Super Friends about
yeah,
the movie?
He is.
I mean, basically that's the start of this movie. It's like previously in Back to the Future, they did this. And spoiler alert for the end of the movie, they do a next time on Back to the Future. It's so sad.
It's a bit of a spoiler, isn't it? It's a lot more than a tease at the end there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on a positive note, they give you closure that Jennifer is not just incapacitated on a porch forever. So they don't leave that plot thread dangling there for all eternity. But yeah, this movie has a lot of incapacitated Jennifer in it, which is weird. This is a weirdly written and constructed movie. But it starts with the end of our last movie, and then it's like, you know, we have to turn that into a new movie. And it does.
Well, it starts with the end of the first movie with like some YouTube kids recreating it poorly, acting it out, because it's not nearly as smooth or believable as the first movie.
I noticed that too, as well as inserting some other stuff in there. And it's okay, I guess, because we don't jump straight from stock footage to the new things they inserted. But at the same time, it is sort of weird. Although it will be a theme for the movie about watching the first movie recreated. Who knew?
All you got to do is add a black mat in the shape of binoculars, and then just put that over top of your previous footage, and then boom, you're good. Even if it's, you know, like a low angle shot from the floor, it totally works.
Especially if you have a difficult to work with actor.
So we paused as if I was going to say something, and I had nothing to say about it.
God, can we just talk some general themes for a little bit, or just general opinions of this movie?
Yes.
The future is bad. The past bits where they're doing a double, triple, like loop through seeing from different perspectives, that's all fun because you get to see all of the building blocks of like the first one and how they put it back together to make a plot, a different plot, but also use the same pieces, kind of, and that's fun. But boy, the first, what is it, like 25, 30 minutes of this movie in 2015 is not fun to watch, particularly because they're cramming a ton of terrible exposition in there, which you would think they noticed that they said the same things like three times. Like, we watched the action and then like two other characters at different times explain what those actions were to the audience, which is not great writing in general, but oh my, just like trying to get through the everything you need to know to set up the problem that we're trying to solve is just like, holy crap. And you got more bad old makeup and stuff, which was apparently a very top secret, very important thing back then.
Yeah, the old makeup doesn't contribute to any successes in the film.
Fortunately for Emmett Brown, he just peels off his old makeup, and he doesn't have to worry about it anymore.
Right, exactly. Enough of that, because this is going to be annoying. I'm just going to look like I looked in the first movie, and we're just going to blah, blah, blah over that.
You know what? The whole first act feels like that to me. I mean, not the whole first act, but everything involving Marty's son feels like one big Doc pulling his face off. It's because you know, Bob Gale and Bob Zemeckis have been outspoken about the fact that they wrote the ending to Back to the Future Part One as a joke and not as a real cliffhanger for a second story. And when they had to do the sequel, it was this consensus of, well, shit, now we have to do something with this. And if had we known we would have to, we would have set up a better story. So you get Jennifer being set aside in the alleyway, and you get everything you get in the first act, I feel like. So I feel like so much of it is just like, is them what you just said with the face of like, well, this is silly, so let's just get this out of the way so we can get to another movie.
Yeah, I read the thing where it said they were bummed that the first movie ended with Jennifer in the car, because then they had to fit her in the story. How great would it have been if they like took off in 1985? To pick up where the first movie left off, and then like they immediately came screeching right back into 1985 and kicked Jennifer out of the car. Yeah. They're like, you know what? On second thought, this is going to be even more messy if we bring three people instead of two people. So why don't you just hang out here for a little bit? We'll be right back.
Oh my gosh, you could have done that now. You could have done that joke now, and it would have been totally fine.
Yeah, Jennifer. They wrote themselves into a corner on that one, because you get stuck with this scenario where she's incapacitated with Doc Brown's alpha whatever sleep inducer, and she passes out. But then they decide to go in directions where they don't care about her, they're just going to deposit her in garbage, and they're going to exert more effort on things like picking up the dog from the kennel than taking care of Jennifer.
Wait, they literally deposit her in garbage. They put her in the trash. You're totally right.
Yeah,
I mean, I never thought about that.
Disused laser discs or something, so it wasn't like she was laying in banana peels or something.
Well, but she was right next to the fusion whatever thing, the Mr. Fusion thing back there. Like, they could have just accidentally...
There was smoke coming out of a thing near her, yes.
Yeah, like, it was not a great situation to be in. They treated Einstein better than they treated Jennifer, but but they don't just knock her out that one time. And the way that they knock her out and leave her there because they're going to go in the time machine to get the dog and do the other stuff and then come back and they go, oh no, we're too late. The police have her now. And it's like, well, you have a time machine, so you could go back and get her from before that happened. Because that seems to be the theme of the beginning part of the movie, except for when it isn't. So this is another situation where they sort of wrote themselves into a corner. And then she only wakes up just long enough for the drama of a certain other scene, and then she's incapacitated again from shock and deposited.
Right, there's a couple of lines that they put in the script there that, like, if you see your future self or something, there could be some sort of space-time rift that could incapacitate you or potentially ruin the universe, one or the other. Which apparently, I mean, I guess it's good that she just like passed out instead of the universe exploding or something.
Oh, it's a shorter movie. But then they deposit her as carelessly once more on her porch, assuming everything will be fine later on in the film. And
he's
then
walking away going, I don't remember there being bars on the windows here. Maybe we should check to see what the safety of this neighborhood is like before we just leave her on the swing, but nah.
And then they, and even when they know that everything in the area is horrible and terrible, no one checks on her.
Yeah, no one does.
Well, and, you know, you got the hooligans with their machine guns shooting at Strickland, and you got the casino there and things. So it escalates very rapidly, I guess, or something.
Yeah.
You know, I would like to take it back. The future, as well as alternate universe 1985, are all very bad. Once we get back to 1955,
totally fine.
Things are okay.
See, okay, yeah, I'm with you. The third act, I absolutely adore. I'm not saying it's incredibly. I'm not saying it's actually great objectively. I'm just saying I personally adore the third act. And I don't mind the first act. I think it's actually fun. I like it as a time capsule from 1989.
Right, but as I mentioned in the little text thing, it feels like a Universal Studios, right? Like, you, for the entire 2015, you expect them to, like, look directly into the camera and go, we've got to go get Jennifer now. Come with us. And then the camera starts following them along.
Maybe that's why I like it. That's probably why I like it. Because subsequently when I go to Universal Studios, that is the movie I think of the entire time I'm there.
Sure.
And possibly because I am wearing my Marty Jr. hat the entire time that I bought from Universal Studios.
I was going to say, Marty do you go as? Do you go as part two 1955 with the fedora and the black leather jacket, or do you go to the 2015 one?
I had a weird meta situation where I bought the hat and then my son stole it. And I thought, I'm not going to get this back until I come from the past to... stop him from committing an inexplicable crime, a crime that I don't understand. I'm not going to go down that road.
You got to wait till some of his friends accidentally knock him out at the throwback malt shop.
Yes. Then I'll get my hat back. So I guess I go as Marty posing as his son to answer your question.
It's very succinct. But I thought I remember you saying somewhere recently that you took your mom to the Universal Studios tour, and then you were talking over what the tour guide was saying, and your mom had asked you to stop talking.
That was on the last week's. That was on the Warner Brothers podcast, the Warner Brothers tour. My mom basically was like, "Shut up! They're paying someone to do this." Yeah.
Yeah.
I bet you would probably point out all the discrepancies in the clock tower if you were on the similar tour at Universal Studios.
No, I would do what I did on the podcast last week, where I'd be like, did it burn down? What happened? Hang on, guys.
Over there was where they did that thing with the flying car, and then they had to fit that for a different street so they could have regular cars driving down in 1955.
Like, can you guys hang on? I'm just going to look on Wikipedia real quick. Can you hang on 1 second? I'm going to be able to tell you what this is. Hang on. That's what my whole tour would be. Just me saying hang on while I Google everything.
Yeah.
Oh, they didn't have Google in 2015, according to this movie.
Well, they had CRT monitors and holograms and hoverboards. And...
Well, the CRT monitors were in the throwback coffee shop, whatever thing. So they kind of saved themselves that way, sort of.
I suppose.
Their projector...
Everything's saved.
Their window in their house was just like a projector screen from like middle school that they were just playing different things on.
I think if you went to an 80s cafe these days, you wouldn't see a CRT monitor, that's for sure.
Yeah, a TV is always the window screen thing. It's like an overhead projector.
Yeah, it's social studies class at home all the time.
The future.
Yeah, back to. But the...
You got your dual ties, you got your fax machines, you got your rehydrator, it's...
I love Doc Brown's Hawaiian shirt with the transparent plastic tie.
It's a good tie. I would wear that tie in all honesty.
It was quite a combo, especially with Christopher Lloyd's flailing movements. That tie flips around in a few scenes.
Do you think it was part of his contract for this movie that he had to say 10 times the number of great Scots in order for it to be an appropriate sequel?
No, I think... So this movie... I know you were asking just me, Dan.
Yes,
I'm
going to
tell you. I think that this movie suffers from, you know, last week I talked about the Jack Sparrow effect. This week I shall talk about the second law of Jack Sparrow. I'm retroactively making them laws.
Jack Sparrow shall, is thermodynamic.
Shall do no harm to a Jack Sparrow, or through inaction cause harm to befall a Jack Sparrow?
Yeah, yes. So the second law of Jack Sparrow is what happens with most sequels, which is... oh, it turns out I'm going to have three laws of Jack Sparrow, so get ready. So I want to talk about the second law right now. The second law is basically that... I remember Pirates of the Caribbean Dead Man's Chest was the second one, I believe. And... pretty quickly, when we get to Jack Sparrow, he starts immediately saying his catchphrases from the first film. And I remember feeling like, oh, we're still doing that? Like, we're not getting more funny Jack Sparrow things? Like, this, we're just going to keep revisiting these things? And it's like we ended Back to the Future... having established this, you know, we started in this normal 1985, and then turns out time travel exists, and we time traveled, and now we live in a world where time travel exists. So Back to the Future Part 2 starts, and now we're in a world where Doc is an elevated version of himself. The whole world is an elevated version of itself, where everything now, time travel exists, and we do it like 50 times. And so... everybody says their catchphrases like 25 more times. Everybody is just a slightly elevated version of themselves. And sometimes that works in movies, and other times it... and I don't think it's bad in this movie, as bad as... like, it's not Jack Sparrow level, like, bad. But I agree. It is noticeable that, like, he has, like, 20,000 more great Scots. They do... they do the running back and forth, which I actually love, but Doc, you know, pontificating about various science and time travel, like back and forth. They do that like three or four times in the movie. Not three or four, that's a lot, but you get what I'm saying. Now, yeah. I've now established the second law of Jack Sparrow.
In this movie, he has definitely turned into the Cosmo Kramer version of Doc Brown. It's not... like, you have to tread a very fine line if you want to, like, you know, amp it up a little bit for the sequel, but not, like, overdo it to the point where the whole movie is just going, like, remember Back to the Future? This is also Back to the Future. Here's a movie. It's like, I think they went a little too far onto the, hey, guys, remember Back to the Future.
Well,
I think they did in the script version. I honestly don't feel like Lloyd's performance is that. I feel like he's actually still... doing spectacular work with, like, they wrote, it's like after seeing Christopher Lloyd's performance, they now wrote Doc for Christopher Lloyd's performance, with Christopher Lloyd's performance in mind. So that's contributing to this, like, elevated form of Doc.
Maybe part of what it is too is the fact that the story has so many different elements that there's really no room to breathe and no room for subtlety and nuance. Yeah. That, like, Marty is just constantly exasperated and yelling, and Doc Brown is just constantly wide-eyed yelling Great Scott, well, muttering whatever he does, Great Scott, and then just being himself in general, I guess.
Well, and they put all that exposition into his mouth. Like, that's like 80% of his lines.
Just talk real fast. Nobody's a question. Just do it real fast. That will be good. We'll get to the third act. Lickety split.
That's the first law of Seth Worley.
just talk real fast. Nobody will notice.
yep. But yeah. I still think Lloyd is great, though. I still think he's unique, and that, like, I don't know. He still get, like, I still enjoy watching him in this movie, and I still feel like he's, like, the only one who can be Christopher Lloyd doing what he's doing in there.
Yeah,
in, like, because he's Christopher Lloyd.
What are the character moments from this movie of him that you like the most, I guess?
I think it's more performance. Like, moments, not even character moments. Like, I just... I'm trying to think of for him. I have Biff moments in this movie that make me laugh. And I have... which, not all of them. I'm not talking about all of them. There's Biff moments that I do not enjoy in this movie. plenty. Get the hell out of my car, old man, is a great... you didn't ask me about Biff. I'm trumping right now and going off on a different tangent.
Not that anyone's ever compared Biff to
to Trump.
No, never happened.
Never happened.
But I do have a Emmett Brown moment, if I may, and that would be when they have Christopher Lloyd by the clock tower talking to himself, and they have that really long split screen shot with the light post. That's really subdued on both parts of him acting as himself in two different time periods in the same scene, which is, I think, quite an achievement for him. So I like that one a lot.
He didn't even try to like disguise his voice at all. You don't think he would have recognized his own voice?
Well, as for the believability of the script, what the directors and writers thought that they'd be able to get away with for that, I there are some questions. But in terms of his performance for what he was doing on set, I thought it was good. Like, he's not running around and screaming about stuff. He does have to say that ridiculous line, or in the past, it's like, you probably shouldn't have said that, like, to yourself.
Yeah, that's the one. It was so not necessary. Like, he completely just, like, gave it away, himself away, 100%, and could have, he was done. He was good. There's no reason to just destroy it like that.
Yeah, but I don't put that on Christopher Lloyd. Like, he didn't write that, but,
I do.
I think that he does a good job with all that stuff. And while I do agree that he is heightened and definitely more amped up than he was in the previous one, I attribute some of that to the fact that the Doc Brown we see in the 50s, which is the most of the Doc Brown that we see in the previous movie, is more subdued than the more eccentric Doc Brown that we see in the 80s, which we only get very little of. And we get more of that Doc Brown because that's the one who's following through in most of this film. In these scenes, but
because
if you go back and you watch the first one, he's making all those wild eyes and talking about weird side tangents and screaming about things and running around and not finishing sentences in an appropriate fashion that would convey information to the person he's talking to, or conveying too much information to the person he's talking to, and you see that in his performance here, whereas in the first movie, the 1950s version of Brown is a little more relaxed and doesn't believe a lot of the things that are going on and is not as eccentric as the older man is.
I guess what I wish they would have done is, and again, I don't know, maybe this is just me, but I wish they would have toned him down a little bit in the beginning when the stakes were lower, so that when the stakes got really high at the end there, when the timelines forked and they have to go back to 1955, that he could be manic and it would make a little bit more sense and it would actually add emphasis to the storylines. But since he's so still sort of crazy in the beginning, where the stakes are basically, oh no, Marty's life kind of sucks and he gets, well, he's not even committed at that point. It's just Marty's life sucks and his kid goes to jail or whatever. He's still being kind of crazy manic there. And then when we get to the end, it's like, yeah, he's still just being kind of crazy. But if he were just kind of like, oh, we need to do the right thing and I have crazy eyes. And then at the end there where he's actually freaking out that like, we ruined the present and the future and now we have to go back to the past because we have no other recourse. Then he could get like, you know, jittery and freak out or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could see that. Yeah, he is, in terms of his energy, he is a little one note.
I mean, when you're always at a 9, when you turn it up to 10 or 11, like, it doesn't really make a huge difference.
Yeah, but again, I think most of my problems are not with the performance as much as with the writing, because Christopher Lloyd somehow has to do that scene at the beginning of the movie where he's dropping off all this exposition about the children and how Jennifer needed to come with and then knocking her out and then saying it's fine and then moving on just so that Jennifer can be put back into the house, just so they can have the scene with the kids at the house. How should I put this? He is behaving in ways that don't seem to make internal sense and for the logic of the film, and I think that I have a bigger problem with that than with the energy level of Christopher Lloyd. Does that make sense as a criticism?
Yeah. I feel like if everyone would have taken a nap.
I agree with that too.
Yeah, everyone should have just gone and taken like a 4-hour nap before they went into the future or then back to the past before they did any of these things to get their head straight instead of just rushing all around and just screwing things up and acting weird.
Well, I mean, it was the 80s. You know, cocaine. or something, I'm sure.
Everyone was either on cocaine or Quaaludes, and then everyone had screwed up mind.
That's the fifth law of Jack Sparrow.
Sure.
Cocaine and Quaaludes.
Cocaine and Quaaludes, yeah. Sure. When all else fails.
No, but they, in terms of the beginning of this movie and experiencing the future, it's fun and it's campy. And there's a lot of visually interesting things that are going on, even if it's not a hugely accurate predictive force as to what the future wound up being in 2015. It's still entertaining to see the kinds of things that they thought that 2015 would have. And sure enough, we do have cafes that reference time periods from long ago that are not done very well, which is a thing that we see in this movie. Although we have nothing that's quite like the Cafe 80s. The flying cars.
That's not true.
Not
so
much.
Pop-up. We have pop-up bars now. We have like the they did the Max in Chicago from Saved by the Bell, and they did like, you know, the Stranger Things pop-up bar.
Oh,
in
that's
Chicago
right. You went
also.
To that one. How was that?
Yeah, that was awesome. It was really, really cool.
So I guess it's a thing that people would enjoy.
What else would I say? What other answer would I have for that question?
I think I saw like 3 Instagram photos, so it must have been a good time.
Yeah, there were like 20 Instagram photos.
Well,
I restrained myself.
If there ever was a bar that was tailored specifically to Seth's interests, I think it was the Stranger Things bar.
What if they put a bar in the top of the Jurassic Park ride at Universal Studios?
Oh, boy. Sorry, I'm just calming down and wiping the sweat away.
Basically, I guess it's like Rainforest Cafe, but with dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah. Well, they have the restaurant in the like, which I have eaten at several times, the Jurassic, what is it called? It's not Jurassic Fork. That's from Parks and Recreation. It's called something else, but it's like it's in the Jurassic Park section. And it's like a little restaurant.
Yeah, and they have that mural.
Oh, it's
type
that
thing.
Has it made,
the
It's made
stuff.
To look like the one from the movie?
Ish. It just that it has dinosaur murals on the side.
Gotcha.
That's really, really it.
Did you have a spoonful of Jell-O, and then there was a shadow that came across the wall?
I just kept wiggling it. My kids were like, stop it. Eat the Jell-O. There's nothing behind us. It's like the boy who cried wolf. Like, and then raptors did show up, and we were all doomed because of my Jell-O. We should talk about something else before I talk about Jell-O for 2 hours.
Okay, so I have a question. I feel like the filmmakers thought things like, we're going to do the skateboard, but it'll float now. I think they thought that kind of stuff was going to be more of a hit than I feel like it was. What do you guys think?
I don't know what you mean by that, because I wanted a hoverboard so bad because of this movie specifically.
Well, of course.
I was about to say.
Who doesn't want a hoverboard?
Like,
no, I mean like the recreation of the chase in the square.
Are you asking 6-year-old me, or are you asking 34-year-old me?
Unless the 6-year-old you is on Skype, I guess I'm only asking.
Well,
this
the 6-year-old you and the 34-year-old you can't meet each other. Otherwise, bad things would happen.
Otherwise, you'll faint and you won't get to be and you won't get to like interact with the story.
But one of you has to shout, I'm young, and the other one has to shout, I'm old.
I do that anyway, just in case. When I see people, anytime I see people, I just shout, I'm young.
Anytime you see your son, you shout, I'm young. And he's like, Dad, no, I'm not you.
No, that is the kind of thing I would do to my son. And it's the kind of thing that, oh my God. And he would hate it just like he hates everything else that I do. Like that. Look, as a 6-year-old, I freaking loved the hoverboard scene. And I don't, look, I honestly, I can't. Oh man, this is a bad idea inviting me because I can't like actively actually criticize a lot of this stuff because so much of it is just, you know how like everybody likes the Goonies, but it's bad, which is the title of this episode. I didn't watch the Goonies growing up and everyone else did. And I tried to watch it as an adult and it was bad.
That's me in the Sandlot.
That's you in the Sandlot? I understand that. As Back to the Future Part 2 for me is, like, I love I can criticize very many things about it, but like when it comes to nitpicking the kind of stuff that we're talking about, I'm sitting here and I'm like, oh, I'm actually listening to you guys realizing I've never realized that Doc's performance is so one-noted. Like, I've never realized that, like, this and that. Like, I've always been kind of like, yeah, that middle part with Biff sucks in the present day, and the future is kind of like gimmicky, whatever, and it is kind of all over the place. But like the hoverboard chase and like the Rick Carter's production design of the future, I kind of love how campy it is and how it's like the 1989 version of the future. That's not to say we shouldn't keep shitting on it, because we absolutely should.
Please,
no, I think what's happening here is I think that it's this explains some of my feelings from last week, because I haven't watched the two movies back to back this close together in a very long time. So last week when I was saying, you know, I was surprised at the subtlety of Doc or some of these other things, you know, the seriousness of Marty or whatever it is, I think that's because, you know, the iconic things in my head are, you've got the hoverboard, you've got the future, you've got 1955, you've got all those things. And I take most of my ideas of those elements from this movie. And in retrospect, the first movie seems more toned down and more serious and more well put together than this one. So it's not necessarily that this one is so much worse. It's just that the other one looks better in comparison. I don't know. I feel like maybe this one was on TV more or something, too.
It was. It was on every Sunday afternoon on TNT, I think, or TBS or USA. Yeah, but the
some Turner or Universal Network.
Well, you said something, though, that yes, like what you said, that you're right. I remember showing my wife all these movies. She hadn't seen any of them when we first started dating. We watched them all the way through, and it's those moments when you kind of realize you're watching through the eyes of someone else. You're like, oh, the first one is better, and oh, these aren't as good. It's when you watch them back to back, when you watch them with someone who hasn't seen them before, I feel like that's when you really notice the differences between them. Because you're right, the first one is so subdued compared to this one. It's interesting.
Yeah, and I would agree that with that general sentiment. I don't necessarily like I don't find this to be bad or anything like that, but it is certainly a different kind of film than the first one is. But one of the things I like about this film are the ways that it subverts some expectations or cliches about sequels, but also embraces other cliches and expectations about sequels in strange ways, because we're literally the third act, which I think we can all agree is probably the best part of this film, is literally revisiting the first movie. And the first act of this is the end of the last film and what we had hoped to see in terms of future stuff. So we can see that visual spectacle on screen, regardless of whether or not it makes sense. And I think the second act is the part that probably feels the least fleshed out, because it's the least sort of logically assembled in terms of strenuous thought that seems to have been put into it by the people writing it. It seems like they had an idea about how things ought to be for these characters, and they wrote sort of a ridiculous world that doesn't seem feasible.
And not only that, it just wasn't pleasant to be in, and they spent so much time in it, and so much time figuring out what it was. It's an act one situation, but it's the entire second act of the movie. And so, like, just as an audience and a viewer, you're feeling like, you're still wondering, what is this movie about? Midway through the movie, and in a very unpleasant part of the movie. And it kind of does that amazing third act a disservice, because you're like, because it's like, oh, this is what the movie's about. Oh, it's about the first movie. Wait, what? Like, and we don't even get a grasp on it until the movie's like over, and we're like, oh, I get now what the movie was. I might watch it again when it's on TNT.
Yeah, I think I was watching this. My wife was wandering in and out, but she wandered back in at one point when we're in Biff's casino penthouse or something. And she just like, she's seen the movie many times, as I have. She's like, what is happening? I don't remember any of this. How did we get here? What is this? And it's like, I could try to catch you up, but it would take a really long time because there have been so many goofy plot points just to get to here. But the bottom line is he has to go back to 1955 and fix the thing. It's like, all right. Wanders back out of the room. It's like, well, yeah, like there's a lot of like, the other thing about that casino stuff is like, yeah, it does feel really bad to watch because you're like, oh, this is not. Yeah, I get we want to avoid this potential future, but this is like, this is bad.
But I actually want to avoid this potential future right now.
We don't
want to
be wandering around cemeteries with flashlights. We don't want to see Lorraine's plastic surgery things.
Nope.
It's just, it's unpleasant all around.
Yeah, and I will say this. While I like the performance that we get from Thomas Wilson, who plays Biff in these, all of the various incarnations, while I like what he's able to do, I don't like the way they wrote things about Biff. 'Cause supposedly, if you give someone a sports almanac, you know, this answers that nature nurture question where they turn into a killer and off someone and take their widow to be their bride. And
well, money just makes you the person you already were, just like exposes it to the world. But yeah, you get to that scene where we're spending so much time with Biff, where he's like telling Lorraine that they're destined and he's screaming in the middle of the street. And you're like, what is this guy's deal? Is it because he grew up with living with his grandma and he seems generally unhappy?
And how is he always? Has he always been this obsessed with Lorraine? He was not in the first one. Like they definitely retcon that particular love.
Yeah.
And you're right. He is. In the first one though, he's a rapist in the first one.
Yep.
He's, and so he's already not like a good person. And in this one, he's a murderer in the you know alternate Biff verse, but like in Biff verse just sounds like a burp. Like this, the word Biff verse sounds like I let gas out of myself.
It's not much worse than Biffco.
It's not Biffco. But the thing is, like he's in 1955 in Back to the Future Part 2 in the tunnel sequence when they're up on by the Griffith Observatory and they're you know he's Marty's on the hoverboard and Biff tries to kill him several times in that sequence just because he's a nuisance. Like,
yeah, I feel like if this movie had a scene inside Biff's house, he would be in his room, like cutting out pictures of Lorraine's face and pasting them on magazine, like women's bodies, and, like plastering his walls with like all of these photos of Lorraine and then like putting himself next to them and just like little cutouts. Like it'd basically be like the opening credits of Seven, but with Biff.
He is.
I'm sorry. That's the best pitch I've ever heard for an opening credit sequence.
This can be our sequel/spinoff.
At least we can replace Kevin Spacey. And that's also one of the things that I find weird about the first. Well, not weird, just very troubling about the first film is there is an acknowledged attempted rape that occurs, and Biff turns into their car detailing service.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is weird for everyone involved, I think.
It's unhealthy.
Yeah, even if Biff were I don't know, repentant and found his way into, you know, things and was able to see errors and whatever. I don't know. Some imaginary version where that happens. Even if that were the case, then it still doesn't explain why Lorraine would be comfortable with George hiring Biff to clean and detail cars in the first film. But then you sort of get that amplified in this one where Biff is just even more cartoonishly evil, and while I understand that there appears to be a grandmother who is yelling at him from inside of a house, how threatening that could be and how his home life must be bad, that doesn't really explain things.
I never interpreted the grandma as like the dark backstory of Biff.
I have an explanation.
Was I supposed to?
I have the explanation.
Okay.
Okay. The grandma voice is in his head. There is a skeleton sitting in a rocking chair in the second story of Biff's house.
Yeah, you never see his mouth when he's leaving, when through the binoculars when Marty's when Biff is leaving, and his grandma is yelling at him, Biff, when are you gonna take the car? It's totally his. He could totally be speaking it.
I want to see a trailer for this movie recut where over black it says a boy's best friend is his grandmother.
Oh my god.
Yikes. Yeah. Well. I mean, the Psycho House is on the universe a lot, too, but...
See, this is what I'm saying. It's all in the cinematic universe. The Biff cinematic universe.
The Biff cinematic... And we titled it.
The cinematic Biff-verse.
Biff-verse. We don't need to talk about the VFX in this movie, but...
Well, I mean, I think we need to say they're good for the era that they were done
they're
in.
They're really good. They're really good for the era they're done in, but they're also really... They're really fun. Like, this is the kind of VFX that I love. This is the kind of thing I was talking about last week about why I love Robert Zemeckis, because, like, you'll craft scenes to where it's like, oh, we've got, I mean, I know we had motion capture for all, not motion capture. That's a different Zemeckis period.
Motion control camera.
Yeah, motion control. We had motion control for a while. This wasn't, you know, we've had it for a long time. It was the Dykstra,
was it Dykstra Flex was the name of the thing? But yeah. I think the one then here is called the VistaGlide or something system.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
And it's like, you look at how many little tricks are in this movie involving that camera, and how difficult they intentionally make it for themselves with characters handing each other things and pouring glass, you know, pouring glasses of water and things. And it's like, it's one of those things where, yeah, it sucks that it's not happening on a better movie. You know, like Forrest Gump is a great example of like a great movie where, it is benefiting like a greater movie. And, but in this case, you know, like, unfortunately it's not a perfect movie, but it's still really fun. This is the movie that for me really kind of like broke open a lot of the filmmaking. You know, I told you Roger Rabbit made me go like, I want to do that. That looks fun. But this movie really was like, oh, wow, you really can get really nerdy and detailed and create interesting problems for yourself when you do this kind of stuff. And it's kind of like, I mean, it's so cliche to say, but it's like magic. It's like performing magic and building magic tricks and stuff. It's just, that side of this movie I really adore. And it's a big reason why I love the whole third act. Like I love, I mean, it's most of it's in the first act, I think too, but the third act has like, you know, the two Biffs, and it has Marty hiding from himself and, trying to think of what other stuff, and you have like that, those kind of effects in this movie are so interesting to me because they are supporting, they really aren't that complex. It's I mean, it's, well, some rotoscoping, and I mean, it's complex with the camera and the VistaGlide system, but from also from like an optical standpoint, a lot of it's like split screens and rotoscopes, so it's like it's not that complex of visual effects, but it's but it is at the time, it was a lot of work. And it's support and the app, but the performances and the scene itself are still actually doing the majority of the heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm. It's not like a robot dinosaur falls out of the sky and steps on somebody. It's like you've got characters interacting with characters.
Yeah, exactly. It's like it really depends on like the characters are having to nail timing of performances to themselves, and they're having to like perform to themselves. And you have camera departments having to, you know, it's just, it's a lot of moving parts that aren't entirely reliant on, and that's not saying that, you know, whatever the alternative is, isn't creative, but it's just, it's a different kind of, it's a different kind of visual effect than you see a lot of nowadays. And it's, I don't know, it's my favorite kind.
Yeah. Well, this is work that requires a lot of extensive planning. And
yeah,
a lot of people have to be on the same page about what you're doing timing wise. You got a camera that you got to deal with, doing the same thing, multiple times. You've got, the cast, performing the same slightly different roles, on multiple occasions. And you have things like props, like you said, being handed off from one frame to another, or, things that you need to make decisions, creative decisions about what can be a logical break in the frame for things to be handed off between one character and another, lampposts or car windshields or what have you. And you also have to deal with some other stuff. In the third act, there is a lot of blue screen stuff where you have to be like, okay, so I need to have this occur, but I want it layered in space so that I have a foreground and a background, not a left and a right. So that creates totally different optical problems, but it's still the same sort of thing in terms of planning and decision making about how you have things that can cross from one to the other and how you can direct the eye around the frame to make it feel like all of these various components are in the same space at the same time, which is not an easy feat, I would say. Even in the modern era, I think a lot of people take that for granted. Just speaking from episodic, and also some previous film things, sometimes people are like, you know, we have three or four different takes that we like of various actors' performances in a scene in this frame, and we don't have one where we like all of them, so the editor has put some soft mats together in Avid, and they've decided to assemble a new performance from all of the various camera takes that they like. And that's a different kind of split screen that I don't respect as much as this, where things are actually planned to occur. And I can really respect what they do to pull it off, because you even have people who are like doubles for these characters who need to perform at just the right time in order for things to happen. Yeah. And then you pull off to the other views that you have. Like, there's a shot when they're all reaching for that ridiculous pizza, and then the camera, you know, we move up and we reveal that it's all of the different versions of Michael J. Fox, the unfortunate Michael J. Fox in drag included, and they're all sitting around the dinner table. So that's but they had just been touching the same pizza, and that's because there were other people doing that because you planned it, and it works so seamlessly, but with seams that we can see, but without seams that anyone else is going to see, that I really appreciate that kind of stuff.
And I love that we can see them. That's a big thing about these movies, is I love that if I look, I can see this. And that's what I loved as a kid, was if I looked, I could see the seams, and that didn't hurt it. It made it even more fascinating to me. It was like this thing that I wanted to pick apart and see like how it was working. And I really could. I got a glimpse of it. There were matte lines I noticed on this one that I had not noticed on prior viewings, specifically some of the flying cars and stuff. And I'm not a purist. I'm not like Star Wars matte line, purist craze. I get it, but I'm not that kind of person. I don't care that much usually.
You don't get the original Snowspeeder semi-transparent mats tattooed on your arm?
Actually, that sounds like a pretty cool tattoo.
No, it doesn't. Like, don't do that.
A party that you're going to get kicked out of pretty quickly.
Yeah.
One of the ones that I noticed this time that I didn't see before, or maybe I've seen before, but I didn't notice as much, is when Psycho Young Biff is screaming at Lorraine in the middle of the road and then walks back over to his car to see Old Biff sitting in the driver's seat, the exposure difference between Old Biff and Young Biff is much more dramatic than I remember it being.
It's that moment, and then I feel like you see it on the tree when he's hiding, but maybe not. I know what you're talking about, though.
But there's also when they're both sitting in the car in the garage, Old Biff and Young Biff.
Yeah.
And the you get the bumps in the dolly move there, or what if the Vista Glide move, where the left and the right frame are bumping differently, so you get an up and down movement that kind of wiggles back and forth a little. It's still impressive to see that stuff. I mean, honestly, if you put me down in front of an optical printer and asked me to do that, I would be like, peace. See you guys.
I feel like this film smells gross. I don't want to touch it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Sorry, what kind of situation where someone would put you down in front of an optical printer?
I don't know. Some sort of bizarre torture thing.
I feel like we should kickstart this. We should make this a thing.
Well, but it'd be like Fear Factor, but with optical printing.
That is greenlit. I just greenlit it with my powers.
I don't envy having to do these things, but I appreciate them being done. And like you were saying, when you're a kid and you could see some of these seams, I certainly couldn't see all of these seams, but when I was a kid and I could see the parts that I knew were effects, and I would talk to people who didn't know how it was done, I'd be like, wow, so I guess it's just really easy to pull one over on everybody. And that's and thus a career occurred. But
this is why you didn't go into makeup effects, because everyone can see that one.
Yeah, but there's even stuff that I appreciate today when I was watching it. When Biff is in his car traveling along Griffith Park or whatever, and the DeLorean is flying overhead, and we have that overhead shot looking down at Biff's car. It ducks behind some trees, and you get shadows from those trees on the DeLorean. Just the amount of work to go into having your model shot do that, and then compositing that in.
Well, you know the one. So, Stu Mashwitz gives to our he gave a talk at our Red Giant All Company meeting a couple years ago. And he was talking about some key old VFX shots, some favorites of his. And one of them he talked about was where the DeLorean lands in 2015 at the beginning of the movie in the rain. And you're in the alleyway, and it floats down, and it's the miniature car that's, you know, composited into this alleyway. And it's as it lowers down, if you look at the hood and the windshield, there is raindrops splashing up and down across on the edges. And what that is it's Vaseline. And frame by frame, you know, someone like Ken Ralston is like coming in with a toothpick and poking in new splashes with the Vaseline. And then they take a frame and he comes in and they do it again. And it's this stop motion Vaseline water drops in the front. It's like, that is so much work going into one thing that I guarantee you didn't notice until I told you, but you felt it. It's just so cool. And I love that you just said, and thus a career was born. That's very much like this movie for me, very much was like so many of my, I've made so many things that have people sneaking around rooms, hiding from other people, hiding from themselves, whether mm-hmm. it be time travel or cloning, because of this movie. And I loved doing it the first 25, 30 times. And you're right, now it's at a point where it's like, it's like, okay, that's done. What's next? But,
gotta get yourself some Vaseline.
Oh my God.
No, I did that too.
Lube it up, Seth.
The first 30 things I did in high school all had me next to myself, and it's dumb me and smart me or something. It was very bad, but yeah, that's the first thing. Actually, the first thing I did like that, I only had a 4-point mat, so I couldn't roto myself. So I'm like, well, how do I make a straight line as I run past myself? It all looks so horrible, but you do it fast. Nobody notices.
Yeah. You just do it fast.
Yeah.
It's just fake motion blur with the feathering.
Vaseline and do it fast.
Oh, my God.
And Joe brings it all together. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well done.
I mean, bringing it together is kind of the point, I guess.
Oh, but, God. All right. That's...
there's one thing that I actually did not realize, and I have to admit something to you guys. You probably already both knew this, and I'm going to sound like an idiot to everyone else who's listening, but I didn't realize that Claudia Wells was Jennifer in the first movie and Elizabeth Shue was Jennifer in the second movie.
How could you not? She's 5 inches taller.
Until when? When was it just now?
Just or? Now. I was looking at the Back to the Future 2 page because I was double checking that it was VistaGlide, and I scrolled down to replacement of Crispin Glover, and I was like, yeah, yeah, everybody knows that. And then it's like replacement of Claudia Wells. I was like, oh, what? It's Claudia Wells.
Joseph.
No wonder he thought the opening was off.
Yeah.
Like, from the original.
Yeah, yep. Different actress.
And boy, did she get the role of a lifetime, right?
Oh, boy. I mean, I'm sure Claudia Wells was kicking herself over the ability to be incapacitated for most of the film.
I feel like if we had a union, this would be grounds to kick Joe out.
Sorry. I mean, so anyway, I was saying, you can really notice the seams and the details, and I take great pride in that.
Well, look, right. Look, I think, Dan, you're due some kind of horrible... confession because I admitted I don't care about Star Wars mat lines and Joe admitted that he's dumb. So
I feel like I've had dozens of these over the course of our show, but I'll see if I can come up with another horrible thing to get chastised about while we're talking.
Yeah. Hey, do you guys want to take a break and talk about what this movie was in the first draft?
Like what are we taking a break from?
Let's throw this over to Seth's first draft corner.
Exactly.
And now a word from our sponsors, the first draft of the film.
So, all right. Everything was the same. I wish that was all. That was all I said. No, everything was the same, except instead of going back to 1955, they went back to 1967 in the third act to retrieve the almanac. Marty... retrieves the almanac easily, but then gets arrested. So Lorraine bails him out using money that was meant for her honeymoon with George. George is not dead in this draft. He is just away on a teaching assignment. Lorraine bails Marty out of jail.
Is he still pretending to be Calvin Klein at this point, or does she know who he is?
That's a good question. I don't know that. I haven't read this draft. I've read about this draft. Lorraine, the money she uses to bail him out, is apparently money that was meant for her honeymoon with George. And so the honeymoon is inexplicably, where Marty was supposed to be conceived, even though he's the third child in the family.
circumvented his own birth, and then does he have to use the almanac to place a bet to give the money back to Lorraine?
Oh, I wish. I don't know how he makes it happen, but they literally spend the whole third act just setting his parents up again or getting them to conceive him.
if it ain't broke in the first movie, do it again in the second one. Put the parents together.
Yeah, more Vaseline.
And so that was essentially it ended with him getting back to 1985, like, and there was no like setup for the third one, even though they were contracted. Their contract was for part two and part three. There was no plan in place yet to shoot them both consecutively. And so Zemeckis's notes, on this draft were mainly that, the middle stuff with the Biff verse was too dark. Like, I forgot what. No, the future. There was some stuff in the future that was too dark. Like George, they had George dead in the future, even though I don't know how. It's stuff that they apparently cared about, but I hear and I don't think makes a huge difference. But Zemeckis' big note was that, look, this is a time travel movie. We have an opportunity that no other kind of movie gets to do in a sequel. We can literally go back to the first movie and we can play in it again. Which is great. And then he was like, also let's do a fourth act in the Wild West.
Why not? I mean, you know, so, the third movie is really, it's for the kids and the merch.
And the contract. Yeah. And So Bob Gale goes off and writes this draft, and it's massive, and it introduces all new characters in the fourth act, and is basically the plot and all the events of the third movie in the fourth act of the second movie. And so that draft did not officially circulate. Bob Gale just gave it to Zemeckis and said, I feel like this is too much. And he said, yeah, let's break off the Western and the third, and they both agreed to go back and do a rewrite, and then we got the movie. But
it's still too much. They took out the Western, and it's still too much.
It's still too much. And so this brings me to the actual third law of Jack Sparrow, which is what happens with most sequels is that every department is given more resources to do their job, except the story department. Like, you have, I mean, look at the various departments in this movie. You have Rick Carter comes on as production designer, and say what you will about the future and everything else, it's like there's a lot of really, really fun design work in this movie and a lot of really great stuff. You have, it's, one could say whether it's the testament to just the fact that it exists from nostalgia, why it's iconic or not, but that hoverboard is a very iconic thing. Mm.
When Nike brought those shoes out a couple of years back, I legitimately considered buying them until I saw that they were like many thousands of dollars.
Oh, I know. Ryan Connolly, as a Christmas gift a few years ago, gave me a pair. I thought, I opened it, was like, oh my God. But I found out it's like a costume version, yeah, that was like $30 or something, but I still have them and wear them often. But like, you know, so, I will say again, Silvestri, like, I feel like this score is so good in this movie. He brings in this extra theme. It's really just a riff on the main theme, but it comes with that like march. And that's like my favorite. And as looking back, I thought, oh yeah, that theme's from all three of them. No, it doesn't come up until this one. And same with the little twinkles. I don't think the twinkles are a thing. They are, I think, in the first one when Doc wakes up when he thinks he's dead at the end of the first one. But the way we use them over titles now, and everyone, and that's like the iconic Back to the Future thing. But I love this anyway. So like every department gets more resources and more money, but the story department is the only one that is
like
not.
The hoverboard has a sound cue even when it's not on screen. Just like, yeah, hey, by the way, yeah, don't forget there's a board hovering down here.
Exactly. I mean, VFX, we just talked about, clearly gets more resources. So everybody gets to really kill it. The problem is that, like, the story department, their greatest resource is time. Like, as we saw with Back to the Future Part 1, like, their first draft, thank God it didn't shoot. You know? But, like, and because they had time on their side, it was able to become the thing that was great. Sequels don't get that. And so you end up getting these movies that are made, you know, these sequels are movies that are made that are just incredibly, incredible aesthetically. I mean, I say Jack Sparrow because Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, that's where we got Davy Jones and Davy Jones' entire crew. It's where we get, I mean, Hans Zimmer's score for that one, far superior to the score of the first one. There's so much cool and innovative. There's like really great action sequences in the second Pirates of the Caribbean, but it's a big pile of trash. Like, it's just not a good movie, and it's a incredibly like nonsensical script. And unfortunately, it's just like story requires time, and you can't give that, especially when you have expectations for a sequel and all these different departments working. And so I think it's unfortunate. Anyway, so that's the third act. That's the third law of Jack Sparrow.
I mean, can we add a fourth law potentially involving restraint too? Because once the first movie is as successful as it is, like having the restraint and not like triple down on all of your like iconography and story nonsense and how many different directions you're going in time, it's very difficult to convince writers and producers to do, I suppose.
Yeah, because it's hard to argue against things where you know that it worked before. So it's like people want more of what they saw that worked. So give them more of that, and
give them more, but also the same amount. Actually, don't give them more. Just give them different things, but similar things.
Well, also, I thought about this one. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to ask, in your research, did you find an explanation for the chicken thing?
Oh, that was created as an overall arc. They wanted to give Marty about his it's about they wanted to show it, like the theme of choices and how like your choices from the past from now affect your future, and they it was the whole idea of like Marty's failed music career in the future, because that was like his fear in the first film, is that I'm never going to be a famous rock star. and so in the sequel, it's like he's not, and he's, and they made him kind of a loser, and they hint to this one event, this like drag race, that this, you know, this car accident or whatever. And I think that they were using that to, I believe they were using that just to basically reinforce that.
It's pretty heavy handed.
It's really heavy handed. It's not really.
He went from like a needed, you know, like, a kind of average dumb teenager to just like an irrationally deeply flawed person who just, you say one word and you can get him to do whatever you want him to do against his better judgment.
Yeah, it does set up a really great pratfall when that door hits him in the face. And the second one, I'm sorry, I love that moment so much. When he's like, nobody calls me, and then the other Marty just like hits him in the face. That's like a really good hit.
yeah, but at the same time, you're like, come on, man, you almost had the movie won here, and you're gonna let your pride get in the way.
Oh, it's so dumb. It's and it's not really characteristic of. I mean, okay, I'm saying this now as an adult. It's not characteristic of Marty, but as a kid, I didn't care. Notice, I could have sworn he said it in the first movie, you know.
Mm. And yet, his pride literally goeth before his fall due to a door to the face.
Oh
man!
Oh. Yeah,
that don't even act like that's a worse pun than any of the crap you've said before.
No, I'm gonna cry foul on that one. But
God damn it!
Yeah, no. The
guys, I'm gonna leave. I'll see you later.
I'm just gonna delete my recording. Hang up now.
No. We've invoked the chicken. You have to stay. No, but the that's one of the things that I find unbelievable about the future scene where he's argued into doing whatever it is that he is doing with his thumbprint that authorizes the thing with needles.
Oh, with the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah, and then his boss from the Japanese conglomerate that seems to own them comes on and fires him with fax machine messages. It's just like it was just a little way a lot of over the top. And then later
just too
on,
many things to look at. Like, you've got this dopey guy, you've got the faxes, you've got the future, you've got his weird outfit, he's getting fired, all of these things. It's like, I don't really care about any of them because there's too many of them.
Yeah, it also, there's nothing we really act on in terms of this arc, in terms of the chicken arc, in terms of this film. And none of the information Jennifer collects from her time with her future family is relayed to anyone because she's incapacitated.
Well, it's also weird, too, because she's just like, she's in a closet watching this scene. So I guess, like, we're all just watching this unfold, and then we're going to take that information with us into the second and third act.
Yeah, I mean, well, no, Jennifer is the audience in that scene.
We're going to take that information into the third movie. It doesn't even get really acted upon or reconciled in any way until the third movie. And even then, we kind of forgot about it until, like, it happens. And we're like, oh, yeah, there's an accident. And there was some firing and stuff. Mm-hmm. I forgot.
Yeah. And we also have another little gem for the third movie deposited here with the clip with Clint Eastwood, and Biff is watching that in his hot tub.
There's also the clip, I think, in the montage of his history about his grandpa, whatever his name was, Mad Dog.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, you're talking about, yes, there's a clip that shows Buford Mad Dog Tannen, but then there's the, but then when he's with the girls in the hot tub, he's watching the whichever Eastwood movie it is, mm-hmm. With the bulletproof vest.
Yeah,
you're
just
right.
Just a light smattering of the Wild Wild West into this movie.
Mm-hmm. Wiki Wiki Wild. But anyway, that's something we can say for next week. Because
at least in the third movie, the flying time machine wasn't a bicycle with wings.
Well, yeah. Count your blessings, I suppose. I mean, one of the things I do like about this movie is that the DeLorean is on full display in terms of what it can do and capabilities, etc. Whereas in the first movie, it was like the DeLorean does a jump, that's it, and then the whole entire movie is about getting
it
to do another jump.
And then it's Jennifer. Well, yeah, yeah. The time machine is the DeLorean's Jennifer on the first one.
Yeah, and in this one, well, I mean, but in this one, you're using the DeLorean left and right, flying all over the place, and then a third one, the DeLorean goes back to kind of what it was in the first one, and you don't get to see it do all the cool stuff. So that's one of the advantages of the second movie, I suppose, is you get all your flying cars and your nonstop time travel, which I think was the promise of the first film that wasn't delivered, and is the thing they take away again in the third film, because otherwise you wouldn't have a third film. So I guess that's a positive to look at in this. Anyone argue with me on that?
I mean, there are many positives in the movie. I think the yeah. story is deeply flawed. The first act is rather nonsensical, but you know, it's still got a lot of the great stuff that you remember when you think about Back to the Future.
Yeah, this movie has a lot of the things you think of when you think of Back to the Future. Even though I think Back to the Future Part 1, or just simply titled Back to the Future, is the superior film, it obviously does not have all of these things that we are that people reference when they talk about Back to the Future. And it certainly didn't have the Pizza Hut promotional tie-ins with the solar shades that occurred.
Yeah, it did not. And don't get me started on that.
but Seth, I believe you have something you want to segue into.
Did I? Oh, I was just going to talk about how I love the ending. And I know the ending is like, I just love it from a totally nerdy standpoint. Well, one, I actually really like everything from the DeLorean. What I mean by ending is from when the DeLorean disappears and Doc is gone, and then Joe Flaherty pulls up in the car with the letter. It's I just really love the dude pulling up with the letter. I love Joe Flaherty pulling up with the letter, and I love the mystery behind it. I love, like, I remember as a kid, like, thinking, oh, because if he's in the past, it's suddenly already, it's been sitting there the whole time, this whole movie, there's been a letter at the post office just waiting to be given to him.
Mm-hmm. You get to see the other side of the time travel equation, where for people who don't travel, it's instantaneous.
Yeah, and I love, I always loved the, it's me, I'm back from the future, and Doc fainting. Like, I love the shots from the first movie, and then Marty running around the corner, and Sylvester's music coming up. It's just so, it's such a weird ending.
Mm-hmm. It's a Bill and Ted Remember a Trash Can moment, where it's just like, if you want to will yeah. something into the future, you just like, think it real hard, and then it's there.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, okay, I'm going to push back on this, because I don't like the ending to this film, because, I mean, it's hard to do a movie in the middle of a trilogy when you know you're going to go on to do a third movie, and you're setting that up. But I don't love the fake out of Joe Flaherty, like doing the "I have something for you," reaches into trench coat threateningly,
and he changes his entire
his entire demeanor because it was a letter, and we're all kind of betting on what it is. So back at the office, then Marty McFly gets the letter all wet, and that's always bothered me. If there's anything I can't stand, it's people getting paper wet. And then
70-year-old paper, man, like treat it with some care.
Yeah, it would disintegrate. But he reads the stuff. And he runs off back to Doc, the 1950s Doc. And I do like, as Seth said, the scene where he runs in and they have that interaction and the Doc faints. But I do not care for, in the slightest, the clip reel of what's coming up next time with the Western music playing over it.
Oh, no, no. And that was clearly because they were like, people may not read the trades. And they may not know that we are already shooting the third one and that it's coming out, which brings me to Pirates of the Caribbean also, again, which is the next sequel to the Pirates of the Caribbean.
Pirates of the Caribbean also.
also again.
They should just call one of them that at this point. But yeah, I know what you're saying with World's End. That because they did Curse of the Black Pearl, and then they kind of went ahead into 2 and 3 at the same time, in a very Back to the Future kind of way, where they did Back to the Future the first one, and then they did the second one going into the third one, all at the same time.
And when they ended that second one, it was like, a lot of people were like, that's it? That's the ending? And so many people didn't know that, like, the third one was coming out. And so that's like why they tagged that footage on at the end. But what I don't understand is why it's still there. Like, why is it through home video releases and DVD releases? Why is this clip reel for the third movie still at the end of that movie? Why does it still say coming summer 1990? Like, why is that still in the movie?
It's there because it's a cautionary tale to future studio executives not to do that.
I don't know. I mean,
that's brilliant.
Would it have taken too much away from the third movie if they would have added one more scene? If they would have brought one more scene from the third movie, which was the finding out that the DeLorean was buried or whatever, and they still have it. Like, could they have ended the movie with that and made a more satisfying ending?
Well, memory serves that still required some time, and I don't know how much time you want to add to the end of this film before it starts to feel like you're going into, as Seth said, a fourth act, because at this point we've been through several cycles of different time things happening, and I don't know how much of the setup for the next one you need to necessarily have.
I guess you would have probably had to have picked one or the other, the running down the street to saying I'm back from the future, or like the letter says, go directly to this place, and then the DeLorean is there, and then it would end there. But you wouldn't really be able to do one or the other. You wouldn't really be able to do both, I should say.
I suppose. And like I said, one of the things that frustrates me about the clipper reel is there's a shot of Jennifer on her porch, and Marty is in, what is that, a poncho?
It shows he got back. Like,
spoiler alert.
Or maybe he got dressed up before he went to the past and then gave her a hug goodbye, and then he's going because he's got a...
But what?
No, you're right. It's bad. It's a bad shot to include.
Yeah, but it's the... while it is a bad shot, it's also the only way we know that Jennifer is okay.
Yeah, but like, do we really care at that point?
I mean, technically, okay, here's the thing. I don't care about Jennifer as a character, but as a woke movie watcher in 2018, I'm concerned about what they're doing with their female characters in these films, because not great things have happened to Lorraine in all of her incarnations, and Jennifer has been mostly knocked out the entire time, and then just left
and
left in a parallel universe where it should theoretically reset to the 80s that you're familiar with, maybe, if you're lucky. I feel like it would have been good if Jennifer is such an integral thing for this character of Marty McFly, to have some concern about her at all in any way.
Well, she's not integral to the character aside from the fact that at the end of the first movie, they tie the two together.
Yeah, but that is part of his destiny, and that it's his future wife, etc.
She's the reason for him to have the clock tower flyer in the first one, because she writes her phone number on the back, and so
he keeps it in his pocket, doesn't it? Yeah,
yeah, and it's brilliant because in that first one, it's that shot where he like holds up like, look, she. Doc asks her a question, which I guess people ask or asked other people at some point in the history of like, one person says, I have a girlfriend, and the other person says, is she pretty? which is problematic. But then he holds...
Well, Doc lacks some social skills. He's pretty single throughout the first two movies.
I thought you were going to say he likes him pretty is what I thought you were going to say.
He does say when he disassembles the time machine that he's going to look into women as his next mystery to solve. So, obviously.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
He's got some issues.
He's not dancing around in a skin suit when Marty's not in his house, is he?
No, Biff is.
That's right.
Grandma suit.
Well, what about we combat serial killer against serial killer?
Oh man.
What if we had a time traveling Dexter?
Oh God! You just pitched something that is going to get greenlit sometime very soon.
Yeah,
I feel like that already exists.
Just travel back in time, and then you it's the perfect kill Jack crime. The Ripper or whatever.
Isn't that Time Cop?
Oh, I haven't seen Time Cop since I was way too young to see Time Cop, so I kind of want to watch Time Cop again.
I haven't seen Time Cop ever.
Well,
oh man,
you are in for a treat.
Join us for our next episode.
Whenever we get to a month that rhymes with Van Damme or something.
Or Time Cop.
Oh, dear. What was the TV series? The time traveling guy, and he had like a credit card that had a holographic lady. What was the name of that? Time Tracks. That's the name of it, with an X. Yeah, that was a good one.
I missed that one entirely. I thought you were talking about Quantum Leap or something.
No, it was on the same time as William Shatner's Trek Wars, or Tech Wars, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know what that is either.
Oh, that was also bad. There was VR and drugs that were computer programs.
Was there an app store? That would make it pretty easy.
I don't think they had the concept of an app store. I think things were still on discs that they would hand each other, but they were tiny discs, because that was the improvement the future would bring.
Well, boys, this podcast has been about as fractured as the movie itself. Do we have any final parting thoughts on Back to the Future Part 2?
I don't think so.
I could just watch all the technically interesting shots of things happening. But, this story is a train wreck. And not even the kind of train wreck that you see in the third movie, which actually involves a train. But a different train wreck. Seth?
I've said everything there is to say about Back to the Future Part 2. No, I haven't. I've said there's plenty more to say, but not really.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us again for the second one. And if we haven't crushed your spirit, we got a third one to do.
Oh, man. That's
my spirit
really
can't be crushed. And I'm going to be... The third one's going to be fun because I really like the third one. Like, not ironically, as a joke. So it should be fun. Join us when I damper all the moods.
Wow. I'm looking forward to that one. And now, cue the clip reel from the third episode.
Ba, ba, ba.
Just recording while I wait on Joe and Dan to call me. Thankfully, no one will hear this. I can sing all my secrets into this mic. No one will ever hear it. No one will ever hear it. Nailed it. Hit that note perfectly.